This is Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Today's program looks at technology in the classroom. What's its place? What challenges can it address? And what new dimensions can it introduce? In the fall of 2010, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan released the final version of the National Technology Plan, Transforming American Education, Learning Powered by Technology. In introducing the plan, he said, "We're at an important transition point. We're getting ready to move from a predominantly print-based classroom to a digital learning environment." An official summary of the plan says it calls for applying the advanced technologies used in our daily personal and professional lives to our entire education system to improve student learning, accelerate and scale up the adoption of effective practices, and use data and information for continuous improvement. It presents 5 goals with recommendations for states, districts, the federal government, and other stakeholders. Each goal addresses one of the 5 essential components of learning powered by technology: learning, assessment, teaching, infrastructure, and productivity. Here to give us some context for this new era of technology in the classroom is Evangeline Pianfetti, former Assistant Dean of Technology, University of Illinois College of Education. Welcome to the program. Can you give us a little background on your involvement with technology in education?
Sure, Elizabeth, and thank you for having me today. I've been with the College of Education at the University of Illinois for over 15 years, and in that time I've been exploring how technologies and digital media impact teaching and learning. In particular, my interests have been in the ways in which technologies are embraced by educators, as well as what challenges they may pose to learning environments, and how we can creatively find solutions that enable us to meaningfully integrate these technologies into the classroom. As a cognitive scientist, I'm also interested in what's happening in our brains during the process of learning when digital media and technologies are part of the learning and instructional process. So I take both a researcher perspective as well as a practical perspective. What's really happening in the classroom, and what do we know, and how can we better help the teachers in the field understand what might be powerful about technology and what might be challenging them, as well as individuals who want to be future teachers, and how we can prepare them for this 21st century learning environment.
Can you give us a little history of the changes you've seen in technology that go into terms like programmed instruction, computer-based learning, e-learning, and so forth?
Absolutely. Much of what is happening in the field of education as it relates to technology integration really parallels shifts in how we envision schooling. If you think about it historically, you know, in the industrial age of education, we were really teaching students how to do specific skills and how to master content. We look at this as sort of like the Henry Ford model of education, where, you know, a student comes in at a certain age, they are in a certain grade level, there are a certain amount of information that they need, and once they get that, they move up to the next grade level. And really what we were seeing was that the teacher passed down his or her knowledge to the student, and the student absorbed the information, and then they were moved on to the next level. While this worked for a post-industrial age, and certainly even farther back, you know, you saw this in apprenticeship kinds of teaching environments, it's not as helpful in today's schooling and in today's society. You know, if we look at the early uses of technology, specifically computers in the classroom, most of it was programmed instruction, where the software was designed to meet the individual instruction of the learning content. So you had one student sitting at the computer, maybe two if there weren't enough computers, but it was really what is known as drill and kill kinds of practice, where the computer assisted the learning by giving out problems. You know, it could be a series of math problems, you know, 2 plus 2, 3 plus 3, 5 plus 5. And once the computer believed that the student had mastered that specific learning goal, it moved it on to the next level. you know, so it was very much showing, you know, the student just had to have mastery of a content before it could move on. A good example of this is the Plato learning system that was developed right here at the University of Illinois over 50 years ago. And the principles of that system and some of the programs are still utilized today because there is some value. There are some things that students do need to master. But in its early history, computer-assisted instruction was viewing the user, the students, as passive recipients of knowledge. Today, when we think about things such as e-learning, we are seeing users and students who are both consumers and creators of knowledge. Emergent technologies that allow students to do such things as build websites, produce videos, create audio narrations, allow the transfer of knowledge and the ownership of knowledge to really be more of a synergetic relationship between what the student knows and what they are being taught. So you see in this type of learning environment that the teacher is really facilitating the learning and the students are taking more responsibility for what they learn, how they learn, where they learn, and when they may learn. And most recently, the increase in online learning opportunities where courses can be held all or partially online and the proliferation of various mobile devices in our society is allowing us to be more accepting of the idea that learning is what's being termed ubiquitous, that it's happening all around us, and it's not just constrained to the four walls of the classroom, it's not constrained to a 40-minute time period, but that we can look at topics and ideas and concepts, and they go beyond the traditional perspectives of the classroom. Keeping in mind that this has always been the way, I mean, learning has always been around us, but the history of technology's growth and the acceptance of it in the classroom has made us all more aware that we have knowledge at our fingertips. Literally, we can use the Internet to find out what we know, that our ability to gain knowledge wherever and wherever we want is very critical. And the approach, if you think historically, of what needs to occur in the classroom is that we have to make our students good consumers of that knowledge. So if they can find something on the Internet, they have the ability to validate whether or not what they are reading or seeing or hearing is actually valuable and to consider how it may relate to the knowledge they already have gained within their classroom.
So you need to give them skills of critical thinking and analyzing credibility.
Absolutely. They need skills such as critical thinking, problem solving, collaboration, the ability to not just accept one source as being right, but to really look at things and the ability, for example, for us to create or to capture a newsworthy event. Let's say you're walking down the street and something, a fire breaks out, like what happened in our campus town. You had citizen reporters that were basically sharing what was happening via their cell phones. But you had to be able to look at that information and know whether or not it was somebody that was getting information just by standing on the side of the street, or were they talking with the fire chief? Were they talking with the owners of the buildings? You know, how we now start to look at the value of the information we're getting is what is the skills that we need to be able to give to our students.
Tell me, do you find that there are different philosophies that influence people's approaches to technology?
Absolutely. As a cognitive psychologist and as a researcher, there are several philosophies for learning that would lend themselves well to how we approach technology in the classroom. But the truth is, we're still in its infancy. We don't know how our interaction is really impacting how students are learning and how teachers are engaging with a technology-enriched lesson. And by this, I mean a lesson in which the teacher is utilizing technologies to help deliver content and in which students are asked to use technology to show what they know. But one of the leading philosophies, though, would be an inquiry-based learning environment in which educators use technology to help design a learning experience in which the students can investigate a topic by asking questions. They can create their knowledge by utilizing different technologies to explore different aspects of a topic. They discuss what they learn, they evaluate that knowledge, and then they reflect on the knowledge to see whether or not they need to ask more questions, if they need to reconsider some perspectives. And so it's sort of this this cyclical view of learning in which it is all based on how we can design a learning environment that would encourage the fact that knowledge is not static and that it is dynamic, and that students as well as the educators can present information in such a way that we can question it and we can use these technologies to help better learn about an idea or a theory or a philosophy. Technologies help us become good investigators of knowledge. That's what I always tell the teachers that I work with.
Do you find the current role of the federal government in promoting technology in the schools, does this plan affect you in your own work, for example, the National Education Technology Plan that I referred to at the beginning?
Well, I think the federal government is attempting to build a platform to help researchers and educators best understand the role of technology and digital media in teaching and learning. The government really doesn't mandate what should be done, but it does offer its perspective through a model of what we know and what we should consider doing in the classroom, which is what the National Education Technology Plan really tries to emphasize, is this model that outlines various aspects of consideration for technology and digital media in the classroom. I also think that the government, through its Department of Education and other agencies, offers grant opportunities for researchers to learn more about what is happening in relationship to the technology and learning and teaching. I think government is also starting to look at ways in which education is transforming as a result of the proliferation of technology in our daily lives, and acknowledging that we need to be able to embrace that aspect and understand how that is influencing what's happening in both K-12 and higher education classrooms, and that this proliferation is kind of redefining who we are as teachers and who our students are. You have to keep in mind that the students in our classrooms today will have jobs that don't even exist. So we have to figure out how we teach and make our students productive citizens in a society that is constantly changing as a result of the technology and digital media. And I think the federal government understands that and is looking at ways in which it could seed research and ideas and development. It's setting a tone for what's acceptable, what might be best practices, and what we should be exploring. And I think that the most recent best example of this is Arnie Duncan's recent unveiling of the Digital Promise Center, which brings together sources in the public and private sectors to support research and development in the area of technology and education.
Well, what is it?
As I understand it, it is going to be a center in which people could apply for funding to look at innovative ways in which schooling and technology can be kind of bridging this shift in this age of 21st century learning. So I think some of the funders are, if I remember correctly, Carnegie Mellon, and different private industry is going to be supporting the center as well.
Do you find that there are any roadblocks?
Certainly. Probably the biggest roadblock that you find is funding. And if you look at funding from a broad perspective of how the schools can allocate resources and the monies to support those resources, because some technologies come with a high price tag. If you think about infrastructure that might be needed in the schools, and how do you sustain the infrastructure so that you can have the latest and greatest, the state of the art within your school. Funding also I look at as the ways in which you can help your teachers get professional development that they may need. If you think about the fact that many of them were trained at a time in which technologies weren't used so much in the classroom. So how do you have the funding, let's say, to release them from a day of teaching and have a substitute so that the teacher can get some training on such things as a smart board, which is an interactive whiteboard that can be used for teaching and for the students to actually physically move around information. There never seems to be enough for anything that is needed, and a lot of times technology is viewed as the luxury. And I think if you think about some of the questions you asked me early on, the idea of what the governments are looking at is it's no longer a luxury but a necessity. Our students are starting to expect it, so we have to figure out how we allocate our monies, what we do have, and our capacity, the people that can help do this, to support the integration in a meaningful way. You know, there are a lot of instances where technology is used in the classroom, but it's used ineffectively, and you find it a struggle because the students aren't learning what they should be learning. The teachers can't teach with the technology because it's just not used in a way that is meaningful and in a way in which learning actually, it becomes a second nature to the learning process, that the focus isn't on the technology but on what the technology can bring to the learning process. I also think that a couple of other roadblocks have to do with understanding how technology should be used, how we keep our students safe, and what kind of policies we may need to help ensure that we are doing the best we can for our students.
That was Evangeline Pianfetti, former Assistant Dean of Technology, University of Illinois College of Education. In a moment, we discuss how technology can help rethink learning in the classroom. You're listening to Examining Education. This is Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. We're discussing technology in our schools. Our next guest is S. Craig Watkins, who teaches at the University of Texas, Austin, in the departments of Radio, Television, Film, Sociology, and the Center for African and African American Studies. Professor Watkins studies young people's social and digital media behaviors. One of his recently published books is The Young in the Digital, What the Migration to Social Network Sites, Games, and Anytime, Anywhere Media Means to Our Future. Welcome to our program. Can you tell us something about your own interest in and experience with technology in the schools?
Yes. So I would say that my interest in this topic really began to take shape after research that I conducted as I was writing my book, The Young in the Digital. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to go into schools and just to look and see for myself how schools were integrating technology into the classroom, to see what young students were doing with technology in the classroom. And so, you know, just being able to observe, being able to listen, being able to, in some cases, even participate in these classroom environments was an eye-opening experience for me in terms of both the challenges and the opportunities that technology represents.
What did you come out thinking? Why do you think we need technology in our schools?
Right. Well, things have certainly evolved just in the short amount of time that I was doing research for The Young in the Digital, which was around 07, 08, 09. And, you know, during that time, you know, I visited a range of schools, some schools that were open to and beginning to, you know, contemplate the ways in which digital technologies, for example, might be used in the classroom. Other schools and educators, quite frankly, were still suspicious and reluctant to adopt technology, reluctant to integrate it into the classroom for a variety of reasons, you know, concerns and anxiety about technology and how it might serve as a distraction as opposed to really pulling students into the classroom environment. Also, obviously, concerns about content, what kids could access via the Internet and other kinds of network media. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I think schools are grappling with in terms of this, the decisions that they're contemplating regarding technology. Now, fast forward just a few short years later, and I think more and more schools are beginning to take a different approach to technology. And what I mean by that mainly is rather than creating and building walls that prohibit young people from using technology in the classroom, more and more educators are beginning to break those walls down and beginning to ask themselves, you know, how can technology be used and leveraged in classrooms to create a much more invigorated learning experience for our students?
So what new dimensions do you think it can introduce?
Well, I think what you know, technology, we have to be careful first and foremost in recognizing that, you know, no technology is necessarily a savior for whatever the ills are that we associate with our education system today in this country. And primarily, I think we're talking about public education, where the masses of our young students, you know, will or will not be educated here in this country. So increasingly what I've come to understand is seeing technology as a pathway, technology as a tool, technology as a resource, I guess really technology as an opportunity to kind of rethink what might constitute meaningful learning in the classroom. And so I don't see technology itself as the savior, but I see technology as opening up new windows of opportunity to think creatively about what education and about what learning might mean in our classrooms today. So the idea, right, is, you know, how do we, you know, create learning environments that are, you know, that connect with our kids in a much more compelling way? So we oftentimes hear, and I think it's true, that we have 21st century kids walking into 20th century classrooms, and therefore what you have is a kind of a disconnect between who those kids are outside of school and then who we expect them to be when they walk inside the school. We expect them to, you know, detach from the networks, to detach from technology, to cut off, you know, all of the kinds of things that they're interested in doing. And while I certainly understand that, you know, that concern about overconnectedness, about always being on, about the need for contemplation, slowing down, taking a break, turning it off, we also have to think strategically, how do we strike a better balance between that kind of concern, but also the need to really leverage technology in more compelling ways. If I can talk about, you know, a project that I'm working on this year, it's a pilot that we're doing in a high school. And what we're doing is we're essentially asking students to develop just a different orientation towards the technology that they use, the kinds of social and digital media platforms that they use. If it's mobile phones, if it's social network sites, if it's social media. I mean, you know, I think what schools can help do is continue to encourage students and educate students about the power and the potential of technology. So we know that kids are using mobile phones to download games, to listen to music, to Facebook, to tweet, to do all of these kinds of things, and that's fine in many respects. But that same mobile device can also be a very powerful educational tool. And so in our project, we're asking students to use their mobile devices as a data collection tool, for instance, to go out and conduct interviews related to the project that we're working on, to go out and capture, you know, photos if their phones are capable of doing that, capturing video if their phones are able to do that. And we see this, right, as an interesting way of connecting their engagement with technology to real-world problems, to what we consider more authentic learning. And so it's this idea, right, that the very tools that kids are attracted to, mobile technology, social media, digital media, even games, represent some really interesting learning opportunities for experiential learning, for hands-on learning, for creative learning. And I think the challenge now is for schools and for educators to begin to think more carefully about how these tools can be used in that way.
What about kids who can't afford those devices?
Yeah, and this is, you know, kind of what oftentimes is referred to as the digital divide. And, you know, it's oftentimes the digital divide narrative, historically has been treated as this idea of the technology rich and the technology poor. Those who have technology and those who don't have technology. So it's oftentimes been defined as a matter of access. And while that certainly continues to be a challenge today, I think it's less of a challenge than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. In other words, most kids, and certainly not all kids, but most kids in the United States are finding ways to access the Internet. They're finding ways to go online. They're getting access to computers, if it's at school, if it's at libraries, for some kids, increasingly via their mobile devices. And so I don't want to suggest that the problem of access has been completely solved, because it hasn't. But I think we've moved a long way in solving that problem. And so the question that many researchers like myself are beginning to contemplate is not so much the concern about access to technology, but rather the degree and quality of participation and engagement with technology. And this, I think, is more a question about literacy than access, more about helping kids develop the skills, the expertise, the kind of repertoire of knowledge and networks and connections that they will need to use technology in a much more empowered way. And so even as we can certainly talk about kids who perhaps live in households or attend schools, you know, that don't necessarily have access to the latest and the greatest, they may not have access at home to broadband, we still need to figure out ways to create learning opportunities for these students, especially in our schools, right? Because if, in fact, there is still a broadband divide, and there is in this country, that there is a considerable percentage of kids who grow up in households that do not have access to broadband, and we know that broadband is a gateway to so many opportunities, both leisure, recreational, social, and educational in terms of the Internet. But this is why schools become even more important, because in most cases, kids can connect via their schools. And the question now is, you know, what kinds of connections are schools making for kids or making available to kids? But more importantly, what kinds of learning opportunities and experiences are schools providing their students with?
How exactly would you introduce these critical thinking skills?
Well, I think you could do it, primarily through what some researchers and educators refer to as kind of project-based learning, where students are assigned projects, assigned tasks that are much more open-ended than we traditionally see in our schools. So what we typically see in schools, kids are given projects, they're given assignments, they're given homework, they're given worksheet, where there's like one right answer. And oftentimes, determining that right answer doesn't necessarily require what you may call higher order thinking skills. They're more kind of lower order thinking skills, repetition, drilling, skilling kids in that way, but not really pushing them to be imaginative, not really pushing them to be, inquirers and, knowledge seekers and knowledge producers. It's more about just giving them information or transmitting information from the teacher to the student without really requiring the student to be innovative or creative in his or her own thinking and discovery and how she or he finds that their own pathway to an effective answer. So I see project-based learning, design-based learning, as really interesting ways to bring these new kinds of opportunities for learning into the classroom and for students. So specifically, projects that are designed where students go out and they do research, where they go out and they conduct interviews. Again, it's this idea of learning that's more hands-on, learning that's more experiential, that's more discovery-driven than perhaps fact-driven. And I think this becomes a way of building environments and building literacy practices that encourage students, to really take a greater stake and a greater investment in their own learning. So education researchers, describe this as kind of student-centered learning as mm-hmm. opposed to teacher-centered or teacher-driven learning, where the students, again, become sort of the drivers, if you will, in part of their own learning, or certainly much more participatory in their own learning.
What about, if you have a large class and lots of kids are on their mobile devices and you have one teacher, how do you turn the kind of inappropriate informal social texting that many of the kids are going to be doing in the class into something educational?
No, I think that's a fair question, and it's one of the concerns that many teachers express about integrating, devices like mobile phones and mobile technologies into the classroom, but it's the degree to which they would be used in ways that were more of a distraction than an addition to the classroom. And so I think you have to be quite firm in terms of your expectations, quite firm in terms of the norms that you want to establish in the classroom around the use of technology. And so kids, have to respect those expectations. They have to, in many ways, perform up to those norms in terms of when we're using our mobile devices. It's not to text about some leisure or social situation. This is about the project that we're working on. This is about a concept that we're addressing, And so it's dedicated specifically to the learning moment and to the learning opportunity. And we have to be fair and we have to be realistic in terms of this notion, right, that for some students, technology becomes a way to escape the learning environment or to escape the learning moment. But I think if you create very finely established parameters, establish clear rules about appropriate use and inappropriate use, establish clear rules about the task and the goals that have been identified and developed, then you have to kind of, develop a classroom situation and an environment and a community of young citizens and learners that will respect and certainly live up to those norms and rules that you identify.
One of the questions I was going to ask you was, what about people who claim there's little research that shows technology actually justifies its cost in terms of enhanced learning by students, but you seem to be having the students have the expense of it in that they're the ones providing the mobile devices, or is this an issue?
Yeah, and I don't think I'm necessarily proposing or that I'm necessarily a proponent of kids in a formal classroom environment, bringing their mobile devices and using them because, again, as you mentioned earlier, you very well could be in a situation where some students, may not own a mobile device or certainly may not own, a smart device or a device capable of performing the kinds of functions that we're describing here. Although, within a few short years, you can imagine a scenario where certainly a significant majority of kids will likely possess and own those devices. We're certainly trending in that direction. But I think the larger challenge, right, is, what are the tools that, that schools and school districts can provide their students with in terms of mobile learning, in terms of social and digital media? And those are certainly expenses and costs, that have to be, considered and have to be carefully, thought out in terms of, what do you go out and acquire? What do you use? What do you integrate into the learning environment? And so whether or not it's the students bringing and using their own technology, their own laptops, their own mobile devices, in some cases that may work. In other cases, you may live, you may be in a school or you may be in a community where that's not really a viable option. And so then, what become other possible options? And that would, of course, be the schools providing the technology and, of course, providing the circumstances, the platform, and the opportunities for kids to use technology in a more meaningful and relevant way in terms of the classroom.
What would be the minimum that you would think that they ought to have in their classroom?
Well, I would think the minimum would certainly be, capable networks. That is to say, networks that aren't weak or, that compromise kids' ability to be able to access information, to be able to, communicate, to be able to collaborate. If they're sharing documents electronically, if they're working on a project in a kind of collaborative fashion, you want that network to be reliable, and you want kids to be able to get access to the information they need and to, go through a process where they're, making, discerning decisions about that information, being able to share that information, being able to post that information, and you can't do that if you're in a school whose network is either always down or whose network simply, again, is not reliable. I would think that would be a minimum, a capable and well and reliably functioning network. And then you begin to think about, do you need laptops? Do you need notebooks? Do you need tablets? What are the possibilities for mobile devices? And those are the kinds of things that, that schools and administrators need to think about. My advice to schools has always been, don't just go out and buy, the latest gadget or the latest device because you think it's cool or because you think it's interesting or because, some other school is doing it. No matter if it's an iPad, no matter if it's some other tablet, no matter what it is, some mobile device, that what schools have to do first and foremost is to develop a strategy, right? A strategy that's unique and specific to their community of young learners, that's unique and specific to their teachers and their leadership, and that enables them, right, to take a much more confident and a much more forward-thinking approach towards the adoption of technology. Oftentimes it's the reverse, right? Schools that can afford it just go out and buy stuff, again, because it's the latest, because it's the greatest, because of these bells and whistles, with no real understanding or no real serious consideration of how that technology will be implemented in the classroom. And I've seen this with iPads most recently, but we've certainly seen it with other devices in other periods as well.
Our topic is technology in education. We've been talking to S. Craig Watkins, who teaches at the University of Texas, Austin. Coming up next, ideas in digitizing content and how smartphones and other mobile computers can be used in the classroom. I'm Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley, and this is Examining Education. Examining Education, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. We're discussing technology in our schools. What's its place? What challenges can it address? And what new dimensions can it introduce? Our next guest is Elliot Soloway, Professor of Engineering, of Information Science, and of Education at the University of Michigan. Welcome to our program. Can you tell us, Professor Soloway, something about your own interest in and experience with technology in our schools?
Absolutely. I have been working for, I'd say, 30 years in K-12, trying to bring K-12 into the 21st century. And only in the last, I'd say, 2 to 3 years do I really see the opportunity to move K-12, which has been in the 17th century, the 18th century at best, into the 21st century. Why? Because of these little things called phones, mobile phones. Mobile phones are going to change education. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. There's no stopping it. Schools are trying their absolute best to stop it. I'd say 95% of the schools in the United States have banned mobile devices, mobile cell phones, from the classroom. But banning books didn't help, right? That didn't work. Banning mobile devices is not going to work either. What schools must do is turn it around. They've got to adopt it, use it. Every child needs a computer. This is the 21st century, for heaven's sake. Computers are everywhere. Every job that you use your mind for needs a computer. Even the jobs that you use your back for need a computer. But yet in schools, we say, oh, no, the kids need pencils and papers, just like I did it. Well, the times have changed. The kids want the technology. The technology actually is beneficial to learning. There's all sorts of data that says when the children use technology appropriately, it, in fact, increases test scores.
But actually, wasn't there that big article about a school in Arizona that has gone into the technology future and its scores are the same?
Yes, there's a front page of the New York Times Sunday. Oh, yes, above the fold. It was lovely. Every few years, there's one of these articles that says technology's bad for kids. And if you really sort of dive into it, you say, well, what happened there? How did that go? Well, what you find out is the kids use the technology a couple hours a week, and sure, they use the technology. That's not the way to use technology to make a difference. All the evidence says that when you automate, that is, when you take a pencil and paper process and you use computers to do that process, you don't gain any benefits, real benefits. But when you informate, that is, when you change the nature of the process to take advantage of the technology, that's when you get the gains. Example, Dell Computer. They didn't use computers to take care of inventory, to track inventory. No, Dell's genius was to get rid of inventory. They used computers to do just-in-time manufacturing. That gave them a tremendous a development edge, which gave them a tremendous marketing edge. They used computers in a new way. If we use computers to teach the old stuff, what is the capital of Pennsylvania? I mean, just this morning I was in a Starbucks, and there was a sign that says, morning question, what is the capital of Pennsylvania? For heaven's sakes, ask Google. It'll take 10 seconds, 5 seconds, 2 seconds. But, you know, how does the rainfall work? Those are deep questions. That's what we should be teaching kids stuff. We need to be teaching kids stuff. We need to be changing from the what and the when. When was the War of 1812? Who was buried in Grant's tomb? All these wonderful questions, right? To why do earthquakes stop? Mm-hmm. That actually is a very important question and a very difficult question. But those are the kinds of questions we need to teach kids to answer, and that's when we need to use computers.
what are the new dimensions you think it can introduce?
It's all about understanding the process. Again, memorization, drill, some of that you have to know. You have to know 2 plus 3. I got that. And you have to know the word READ. It's read and read. Those are sight words. You've got to memorize a bunch of stuff. No question about it. But you have to use your mind to ask questions, to problem solve, to work collaboratively. Those kinds of activities are what you need to do in the 21st century. Teamwork. In a team, you work together to solve a problem. In the business world, you wouldn't even think to solve a problem without using computers. Of course you use computers. Use all the tools that you can to just make the job a little easier, to make the job more effective. Whereas in school, we say, oh, no, we just don't want those computers. We want to be able to just take the books and make the kids read. Well, for heaven's sakes, they're not going to do that. Their worlds are different. They need multimedia. They need to see the world differently. That's what technology can do. It enables the kids to do what they do outside of school, inside of school. And the kids are very effective with the technology outside of school, so let's use it inside of school.
So what barriers do you face aside from these attitudes? Are there other barriers?
Well, it's interesting. For the last 30 years, again, I've been trying to use technology in schools, and the barriers, by and large, have been cost. The computers just cost too much. But now that is over. Every child, over the next 2 to 3 years, every child will bring their own computer to school. It's called a smartphone. And they will bring that to school. They're going to put it on their desk, and they're going to look up. And schools have a choice. They can say, put that thing away, ban that thing, or they can say, okay, now, this morning we're going to study the water cycle. Let's, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And in studying the water cycle, they're going to use the device the kids have in their pockets, the device that the kids have been using outside of school very effectively. So cost is no longer the barrier. And the barrier now is attitude. It's just as you said, it's attitude.
Wait a minute, not just attitudes, but what's the minimum that the school will need to support the mobile devices?
Ah, very good. By and large, the children will have data plans that so they can go out to the Internet, because if you buy a smartphone these days, you have to buy a data plan. So they will bring to school a computer that is connected to the Internet. So what does the school need? Very, very little, actually. There's a lot of curriculum that's out there that they don't need to buy textbooks anymore, because all the content is on the Internet. And there's content about rain, about the water cycle for third grade. There's content about there's content about rainfall for middle school. And there's content about rainfall or the water cycle for high school. It's all out there already. Schools do not need to buy those textbooks anymore, and textbook companies are petrified. So what do schools need? Very, very little. The kids will be bringing it to school themselves.
Don't they need, like, connection to the Internet or networking? Or
the network will be provided in the device itself, and the device itself will have the network. Today, if you want to buy an iPhone or an Android or Windows Phone 7 from Verizon or AT&T, you must buy what they call a data plan, a plan that connects it to the Internet. You can't buy a smartphone without a connection to the Internet. So, in fact, the kids will be bringing two things, the computer and the Internet connection to school.
And you don't see the cost being a barrier for some children?
Yes, there's going to be a problem. There's always going to be a divide, a digital divide. There's always a divide, and there's some children who have it and some children that don't. So the school will need to provide for that subsection of students, if they don't have a computer and a connection, the school will have to provide it, absolutely. But up to now, the schools have to provide 30 of them. Well, they can't do that. But if they have to provide 10, 15, 12, 6, they certainly can do that.
And then if every child has a different device, it still is going to be able to be workable in one classroom?
Very good point. The heterogeneity is a problem. So how do technology solve heterogeneity? A layer of software that makes all those devices the same. You can have a Dell computer, you can have a Sony computer, you can have a Gateway computer. You put a layer of software on it, and all those computers are the same. That's what education will software companies will be developing. There is actually software companies out there already that develop a layer of software that makes all those heterogeneous devices homogeneous.
So where do they get the software from? The individual gets it, or just the school?
Well, that would be an interesting question. Maybe the school will purchase it, or the school will have, you know, a list of supplies, right? In the beginning of September, they always send you this, the parents, a list of things. Bring these to schools, okay? On the list will be that piece of software that every child will have to buy. It won't be more than $6 or $8 or $10. I mean, it's going to be low priced. But if the parents don't buy it, then indeed the school will have to provide it. But again, you're talking $6, $8, $10. You're not talking hundreds.
Well, going back to attitudes, I know from my own connection with school, it is very difficult to supervise all the students, and they do often go on to social networks and use inappropriate language or go on to a lot of inappropriate sites. How do you deal with that?
I can hear in your voice. I really can, and your questions. You're really concerned. You're really worried. And I'm sympathetic. I absolutely am sympathetic that this will cause problems. And indeed, you're right. Some of the kids, not a lot of them, some of them will be doing inappropriate things. So how should school deal with it? Education. How do we deal with inappropriate behavior in general? Education. We need to teach the kids responsibility, to take charge, to take a charge of their own actions. And if children do something inappropriate, there has to be consequences. So if a child is viewing something inappropriate, then they lose the privilege, they lose the right to use that technology for a period of time. Absolutely. And the kids will get it real quick. If I lose the right to do my work on a device and I got to go back to paper and pencil, I'm not going to go into inappropriate sites. The kids, most of the kids are dutiful. They won't be causing problems. So it is, to my mind, way overblown that problems will ensue.
Mm-hmm. But you've heard this problem. You've heard this.
All the time. There's three problems that people tell me immediately with mobile devices. The screen's too small, the keyboard's too small, and kids will cheat. And certainly for the bifocal generation, we do have trouble reading the screen, and our fingers are big and fat. Yes. But for the kids in K-12, I've never heard a child say, oh, I can't play my Nintendo. The screen's too small. Oh, no, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. Never heard a child do that. For them, the screen is not too small. For them, the keyboard is not too small, and kids have cheated with paper and pencil. They pass notes. They're always going to cheat. Some kids are going to do things that are inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And we need to set up a system so that we can educate kids to not do that. And when they do it, we need to punish them.
Uh-huh.
The way it works.
Uh-huh.
Always the way it works.
So, have you worked with any kind of administrators to do this? For example, what about state technology directors? Do you work with them at all?
I try to work as high a level as I can. I tend to work with teachers, principals, and superintendents. Though I do work in the country of Singapore, and I work with the Director General, Ms. Ho Peng. She is the Director General of Singapore, and we are working with her because she understands that this is what her children all over Singapore need. Yes, Singaporean kids do very well on the standardized tests. And the way they do it up to now is drill and practice. They use worksheets and they drill the kids. But this does not make children innovative. This does not make children imaginative. And the Director General of Singapore understands that and wants to bring new pedagogy into her schools. And the way you do that is you bring the technology with that pedagogy.
So are there any examples here that you've
certainly.
What?
Lots of schools are doing. I'm working with schools in Iowa. I'm working with schools in New Jersey. I'm working with the schools in St. Mary's, Ohio. They're doing it. Schools in Stratford, Iowa are doing it. Toms River, New Jersey, they're doing it. All over America.
So you have classrooms where every kid has a mobile device?
Absolutely. Akron, Ohio. There's a school in Akron, Ohio, Summit Academies, and these schools are just special needs kids, kids who have been labeled special needs for whatever problems. And I'll tell you, you go into those classrooms, and those kids are engaged all the hour of the classroom period using their devices, learning. Absolutely.
Are there any other issues that you would like to mention that we haven't talked about?
I am very concerned that the industry, the educational industry, is going to have to retool because they are right now on a major stumbling block. The textbook companies have made a tremendous sums of money on dead tree materials, and it's going to change. It has to change. The record companies, the music industry, the TV industry, the video industry, all these industries have gone through upheavals and are going through upheavals. The textbook industry is resisting, and they are causing problems in schools, and I really hope that we can reach some sort of agreement with this industry that says the future is digital. Let's move there together. We'll still figure out a way to make money, but let's move there together.
Well, so what do you envision?
What I see happening is more and more content being put on the internet by citizens. There are citizen journalists. There are citizen scientists, right? All sorts of folks are participating in these professions that have never participated before. All the bloggers, the writers. So they're going to be putting content up on the internet. We need companies to put content on the internet. We need companies to create curriculum. Textbooks are not just for students. Textbooks are for teachers to provide them with curriculum guides for what they should teach in school. Well, we still need that in the digital age, so there is definitely a role for those textbook folks. And I want to be real clear, this is not about getting rid of teachers. Well, we're going to do online education and sit kids in front of computers and we don't need teachers anymore. Wrong. Teachers provide a very important, critical role in the classroom. Teachers help kids learn how to evaluate information, how to evaluate ideas. Kids are struggling to learn. They need help to learn how to work together. Teachers are going to play an increasingly important role in the classroom. Yes, technology will be an integral part of the classroom, as will teachers.
We've been talking to Elliot Soloway, professor of engineering, of information science, and of education at the University of Michigan. Today's topic was technology in education. Next week, we will talk to a school superintendent, a district director of information technology, and a principal about the nitty-gritty of bringing technology into the classroom. We have a website, examiningeducation.org, where you can listen to past programs, find out more about our speakers, follow links to other websites with more details about issues raised in our discussions, and where you can send us your suggestions and comments. You can also find us on Facebook, Examining Education. Today's program was produced with help from managing editor Jason Croft and audio support from Mike Pritchard. I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. This is Examining Education.